This is Conquering Columbus.
Hey, everybody, and welcome to episode 357 of the Conquering Columbus podcast. This is your co-host, Mike, here to give you a quick preview on this interview. And today, Josh is talking with Bruce Garfield. Bruce has an impressive career in the music industry, working with bands and artists like the Red Hot Chili Peppers, David Bowie, and the Steve Miller Band. And today, he leads the Columbus Music Commission. Early on in the show, Bruce spoke about how he first ended up getting into the music industry and happened at a concert.
There was this upheaval of the 60s happening around me, civil rights and anti-Vietnam War demonstrations, flower power. And just by chance, selling posters at a concert, I met a famous record producer and songwriter and just walked up to me and said, "Hey, kid, I like the way you handle yourself. Here's my business card. Why don't you come to my office next week?" At that point in my life, the only office I'd ever been to was a doctor, a dentist, and the principal's office a couple of times. And it opened me up to the fact that there was a music business, because when I went to his office, there were gold records, awards adorning his walls. And he asked me to go to work full-time, going on tour with major artists who signed his poster company.
Later, Bruce talked about how asking for what he wanted from his boss led to a big career pivot.
So I went back to the president of the company and said, "I'd like to go into the A&R department." That's the department that actually signs the artists. And remember, he said to me, You're dreaming. It'll never happen." And I put out an empty threat and said, "Well, if you don't do that, I'll probably just leave." I didn't know how to leave or where I could go, but I just let that sit with him. And then about a month later, he said, "I think we're going to make your dream a reality. We're moving you to the A&R department." And that was the move I wanted, because now it was in a position to sign artists, of changing the company to some extent. I had something better to sell. And I still had all those people in press and artist development were my hires. So I could not only sign the act, work with them making records, but I could walk them through the system.
As we wind down the show, Josh and Bruce discussed the Columbus Music Commission and how Bruce got involved.
I wanted to make a difference. When I saw Columbus, I said, you know, this is a city that I feel I can make a difference in. I want to find a way to weave myself into the fabric of the city. You know, whether it's volunteering for Nationwide Children's Hospital or any of the philanthropic organizations you can work with. And I was actually going to start a new company after I settled down with Scott Steinecker from Promo West. And a neighbor said, "Hey, Bruce, there's a Columbus Music Commission and they're looking for their first executive director." And I kind of pondered it and said, "Wow, that could tick all the boxes, because I could give back some of the good the music business has given to me. I could help establish the fact, Columbus, that there's a huge music business economy. And I could see a tangible difference being made."
This episode gives you a great look into the music industry. And as always, we hope you learn a lot from the conversation with Bruce. That's it for this preview. Let's get on with the show.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Conquering Columbus. Today, we have Bruce Garfield. Bruce is the first executive director of the Columbus Music Commission, role he has served in since August of 2018. Following his move to Columbus in November of 2017, before the Columbus Music Commission, Bruce had a successful career as both a major record label executive and talent management, working with artists like Sinead O'Connor, Grace Jones, Isaac Hayes, Ziggy Marley, LFO, War, as well as leading career development for Duran Duran, Bob Seger, Steve Miller Band, and the Red Hot Chili Peppers, David Bowie, and many more. His goal is to help make Columbus the Midwest music capital of America. We're excited to talk with him today about how the Columbus Music Commission helps make that happen, his music career, and a whole lot more. Welcome to Conquering Columbus, Bruce.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So we always start back, I mean, especially someone that's had such an interesting career and been around so many incredible individuals as yourself. You know, where did you grow up and what was your early childhood like, to the extent that you can share some things?
I grew up in the Bronx, New York City. My parents were both lovers of music. So I grew up in a household where there was always music playing and a big box of records. I remember my father giving me records from TV shows, children TV shows. And I ended up moving on to becoming a member of the junior band in middle school and the band in high school. It gave me the opportunity to socialize with kids from other schools I'd never met. It was a team that I could play ball on because I wasn't tall enough to play basketball. We were the Bronx, so we had no football team because we had a concrete schoolyard. And it further instilled a love of music.
That music love, like I can see where it drives deep at a young age, but to then go on and aspire a career at that, I mean, that many dream of, only few achieve. So you go through high school years, you eventually decide to go off into college. And then where do you go off to college and what do you decide to study when you go out there?
I went to UCLA, so it's a long way from New York City. Oh my goodness, palm trees, and I don't have to go to a park to see them. And I didn't know there was a music business. I put my trumpet down and, you know, what good is a trumpet going to do me? There's no trumpets in rock bands. And while I was going to school, there was this upheaval of the 60s happening around me, civil rights and anti-Vietnam War demonstrations, flower power. And just by chance, selling posters at a concert, I met a famous record producer and songwriter and just walked up to me and said, "Hey, kid, I like the way you handle yourself. Here's my business card. Why don't you come to my office next week?" At that point in my life, the only office I'd ever been to was a doctor, a dentist, then the principal's office a couple of times. And it opened me up to the fact that there was a music business, because when I went to his office, there were gold records and awards adorning his walls. And he asked me to go to work full-time, going on tour with major artists who signed his poster company. And of course, I didn't want to give my parents coronaries by leaving school. So I continued to do it on weekends and, you know, on vacation time. And eventually I bailed on school and went to work for him full-time. And I was out on tours with major globally recognized artists. So I was exposed to records, artists, managers, songwriters, producers, publishers. And I finally had this broad scope of what went into a music business.
Did you ever reflect back on what about you struck out to that individual and how you were able to just show up to the office that day and end up winning what most people who, if they knew what the music industry was, probably aspired for a position like that?
Well, I didn't know there was a music business. And what he was attracted to is my tenacity in doing a good job. I mean, I had to get a job when I delivered groceries after school in the Bronx. So I've always tried to do the best I can and almost, you might say, blind enthusiasm to do a good job. And that's what attracted this producer to my energy.
And who was this individual?
His name is Jerry Goldstein. In fact, he produced Hang On Sloopy. He wrote My Boyfriend's Back. He's written, you know, real famous songs from the 70s. Just a successful character.
So you're going on tour. Are you traveling all over the U.S., all over the world? And what kind of artists are you going on tour with?
Well, it was just the U.S. And I was just like, you know, out of my teenage years. But I was out with Jimi Hendrix, The Cream, The Doors, Steppenwolf. I mean, it was such an experience for me because I was starstruck. And now I'm seeing the artists and I'm backstage with artists whose records or, you know, music was in my car tape player. It let me see the business from a different perspective because now I was behind the microphone, literally experiencing what they experienced and learning how the business worked.
And how does your career start to evolve from there? You go on this tour, eventually you don't finish college, right?
No, I didn't.
Much to your parents, I got to assume they weren't super excited about that.
No, and I studied child and abnormal psychology, so it came in handy during my career.
And so you finish up this first tour. Do you continue to start working in the same position when you come back after that?
Well, a tour was over. One of the major tours was over, and I wanted to get closer to the music. And my boss said, "No, no, stick to the posters. You're great." And I just had this yearning to be closer to the artists on a continual basis, the same artist. And so I was headhunted by one of the managers of one of the artists I work with in the poster business. And then that led me to meeting people who ran independent record labels. And I was recruited by one of them. And then they had a deal with a publishing company. And I was recruited by that publisher company. And then I went back to them and worked on several artists they had on Capitol Records. And Capitol Records was a fairly sales-oriented company. They didn't have any real feel for artists. They just sold vinyl. And one day, after working with them for a year, the president of the company asked me to come by and said, "Look, we'd like to offer you a job to run the press department. And before I go further, I want you to know we don't want you to become us. We want us to become you." And I took that job. And that—
How old are you at this point?
Probably about 26.
So you had so much of an influence and a sense of energy with the people that you're around that he was willing to say something like that to you at pretty young age.
Yeah, I always flattered because I was the youngest national executive in the history of this classic record company. You know, I felt like sometimes I'd go visit a branch and I'd walk in and they'd look around and say, well, when's your father getting here?
And so talk to me about the press. So the music industry, I don't think as many are as privy to it. I could probably say that I'm pretty ignorant to many aspects of it too. And it seems like it's evolved a lot ever since digital's come into play and now kind of the power dynamic changes between the people at the platform versus the artist. So back then, you have your artists that are making the product and they're the creatives and they're putting together with their production team and their managers are helping them figure out the tours are going on. And then you have the record labels. And can you explain the role that the record labels and press are playing in the whole dynamic?
Well, of course, the record labels who signs them and finds them or fights to sign them to their company. Then the A&R department, who's played a role in bringing them to the label, works with them to make the records. They deliver the record, and then they're presented to marketing, sales, radio,
that's
publicity.
When distribution starts.
Well, the plan is put together. Even the records haven't even been pressed yet. And so we start to put a plan together. And usually the first kind of assaults in marketing come from radio and publicity. So I realized that up to that point, most publicity people at record companies used to refer to critics as dear critic, dear opinion maker, dear taste maker. And I realized from working with artists that these are journalists. They have a responsibility to their editor. The editor has a responsibility to the publisher. And the publisher has a responsibility to readership. So I decided I was going to refer to them as journalists and let them know through a mass letter I sent, because there was no computers then. We had mailing addressograph machines with plates that had their info on it. And I wrote to them, it was a dear journalist letter. And it would say that I inferred that I'm not going to push stuff I don't think is newsworthy to them. I always say to people, I'd rather have a number 10 record with a real good story than a number one that was about as deep as a glass of water. And it started to give me entrance and respect. Then 6 months into the job, the president of the company, Don Zimmerman, called me into his office and said, we'd like to give you the artist relations department, but we can only give you a token raise. Thinking back, I should have said, well, I'm not going to give you a token performance, so why should I accept a token raise? But I was just wild about that opportunity. I changed it to artist development. I looked at it from a different perspective, and I put the best artist development department together in the industry. That year, all of everyone I hired went on to real important major careers as managers, heads of record companies, et cetera. So it was like the biggest chemistry set a kid could believe they were gifted.
And so you changed from, I want to recap all this and you can poke holes in what I'm getting wrong. So our press is our way to get attention, right? So when we're putting out an album, it's kind of like this weird power dynamic where we need access to all these attention points to get it out into the public. Then all of a sudden, the attention changes to the artist. Now they kind of have the power all of a sudden. Maybe not so much back then, I guess, because the press still controlled everything. You didn't really have digital.
Artists didn't have, the artists didn't have the power. I developed a real camaraderie with artists, seeing what I felt was the value and really sitting down with them and their managers and say, here's my plan. Give me the next year of your life. No questions asked. Just do it. And if a year from now, I don't achieve what I'm setting out to do, I'll assume the position and you can, kick my ass. I mean, to be blunt about it. Perfect example of this was working with Bob Seger. I asked Bob to give me the next year of his life. And if I didn't achieve what I'd set out to do, he could kick my butt. I wrote to the journalists in the country and appealed to their sense of integrity in an artist and asked them just to listen to his record because he delivered a double live album, which was unheard of. They wouldn't get it on the radio. And they responded and started to write about him. And I said, he's America's all-American rock and roll hero. Well, less than a year later, there was a big article on Bob in Newsweek magazine. It was a double truck color centerfold. It was a picture of Bob and his dog, Boris, sitting on the couch. Bob is holding a guitar. I sent a letter to Boris Seger, to the dog. And I said, Boris, it's really great to see you in Newsweek magazine. I have one question. Who the hell's the guy with the guitar? And then my relationship with Bob started there, and it just went on for years. He wrote me into songs, and I still have that relationship with him, and that's a lot years later. But I'm underscoring the point that if you're a human being, you don't come off as a suit. You realize that an without the artist, you might as well be selling used cars. Not everybody takes that position or has that outlook on the artistry itself because it's what powers the industry.
And so you moved from press into, was it, you called it artist development?
Artist development.
And how much more did that encapsulate over what you were just doing in press?
Well, now I took over all television appearances, all touring, all subsidizing tours, and I controlled every dollar the company spent on ticket buys to send journalists and salespeople to shows. There were parties in every major city in those days, so I controlled every extracurricular dollar. So I became really good friends with all the promoters in the country and all the club owners in the country and all the agents in the country. So now I had built this kind of network, which came naturally to me. It's like, how do you make this thing happen? How do you do a better job? You figure it out yourself. It was natural to me. And that's really how we became a true artist development department and had a very large, potent say in what was going on in the company.
And at this point, are you just following your passion in music and enjoying the ride? Or are you thinking about, you know, how can I eventually continue to move my career higher and higher? And are you chasing monetary aspects of it?
No, I was making more money than I dreamed I could make. So the money was there. And that's why I took the token raise to move up to the, you know, incorporate both departments. But I wanted to get closer to the music. So I went back to the president of the company and said, I'd like to go into the A&R department. That's the department that actually signs the artist. And remember, he said to me, you're dreaming. It'll never happen. And I put out an empty threat and said, well, if you don't do that, I'll probably just leave. I didn't know how to leave or where I could go, but I just let that sit with him. And then about a month later, he said, I think we're going to make your dream a reality. We're moving you to the A&R department. And that was the move I wanted, because now it was in a position to sign artists, of changing the company to some extent. I had something better to sell. And I still had all those people in press and artist development were my hires. So I could not only sign the act, work with them making records, but I could walk them through the system and had, you know, a pretty high degree of impact in the careers of lots of artists and in the company.
Hey, everybody, Mike here. We're going to take a quick break to talk about one of our sponsors, One Columbus. And we are very excited to partner with One Columbus. They really, really share the same vision as us here at the Conquering Columbus podcast, which is really building up the Columbus region to be one of the most prosperous regions in the United States. And One Columbus serves as the business location resource for companies across Central Ohio and around the world as those companies grow, innovate, and compete within the global economy. And they help us lead a regional growth strategy that develops and attracts the world's most competitive companies, grows a highly adaptive workforce, and prepares our communities for the future, inspiring innovation across the board. Their mission really is just ensuring the Columbus region is a vibrant place to build businesses and careers. So again, we really appreciate all of their support. You want to learn more about them, go check out their website, columbusregion.com. That's columbusregion.com. Thanks so much for tuning in. We'll be right back into the episode.
And so in the A&R department, how involved do you get in the production aspects of the thing at all, or is it really just identifying the artists and signing them?
Well, it's interesting because first you sign an artist and you sign them based on whether they've already had a career at another label or they're brand new. In those days, you just signed them on the music itself. There was no how many streams you have on Spotify or how many views do you have on either TikTok or YouTube. We'd sit down and go through songs. And then we discuss what producers were out there. And I try to put together a marriage between the artist and a producer. Some cases, some producers were more song-oriented. Others were focused on sonics. Some were sonics and arrangements. And make that marriage and then work with them as they were, you know, collaborating. I'd get weekly songs or recordings sent to me and I'd review them. And I'd stay away unless I felt there was a real reason to show up. And we deliver good records. And I would take them, many cases myself, into the mastering room where you fine-tuned it to actually make the process of manufacturing take place. So it was a start-to-finish endeavor. And it was great because now I was becoming a hot A&R man. So I was attracting more talent to the label.
And how long do you do that for?
I did that for, oh my God, about 5 years. But what I did was also put capital in the youth music business. I kept saying to them, well, we have all these older artists. We have Paul McCartney and we have Steve Miller and Natalie Cole and all these artists, are, you know, a lot older than me. And I said, there's an independent scene. There's a new wave scene happening and we need to be in the youth music business. This, go do it. So I signed a band called The Knack. It was my first signing. They have a song called My Sharona, and it became a worldwide hit. And then I went to England to visit our sister company, who had a little band called Duran Duran. And I came back with it, fought with our promotion department. They said, we'll never get that stuff on the radio. I said, just leave it alone. MTV's happening. And they became the first MTV band. So it was really gratifying. They had an impact. And then my profile in the business became elevated. And I was not even thinking of ever leaving Capital. I just looked at the whole industry and said, we're kicking your butts. And I enjoyed doing my job. I wasn't, though I got promotions and I got raises, that wasn't my motivation. My motivation was doing a good job and working with artists.
And at what point do you decide that it is time to move on?
Well, it harkens back to Capital was a wholly owned, privately held company by an English company called EMI. So we had no stockholders to please. We had a board. They were piranhas. I'd get called up at least once every quarter, if not more frequently. My budget would be looked at and I'd have someone be pointing a finger at me. Devoid of whatever my results were. We need 10% on top of that performance. But it was like we had all this latitude. It was a culture to Capital. And one day I kind of woke up to the news that Capital was sold as parcel of EMI to a publicly traded British company called Thorne. They made light bulbs, television sets, missile guidance systems, and they were products. You know, they were making products, electronic products. And before I knew it, I had a Goldman Sachs suit in my office with a clipboard asking me what I did. Now, at that point, I'd become the president of the EMI Capital Group on the East Coast. And after I told them what I did, oh, so you signed the artist? Yes. You helped make the records? Yes. I see this guy, David Bowie, has sold 25 million records last year. You need to make him come in and deliver a new record for this fiscal year. And I was thinking that, you know, if David had walked in the office, I'd say, just turn around and leave because you can't be missed unless you go away. And I tried to explain that to this person and he wasn't buying into it. And they eventually went around me.
Explain that a little bit more. So your comment there, you're saying that exclusivity factor of not releasing that album made it more enticing?
I'm sorry, I cut you off. Go ahead.
No, that was all I got. I cut you off too, but I was interested in that particular point.
Well, Let's Dance was David's biggest record in his entire career. And he toured globally behind that. And you need to let things settle down. You know, you don't release one single, another single, another single. And this fellow said, we want that in our next year's fiscal bottom line. And I was saying, well, you know, it's not a cow. You don't send it out to pasture, feed it, and then milk it again. You know, he didn't like that. He had no understanding of how artists work. So they initiated a workaround me. They went to David's accountants, offered him $1 million, non-refundable, non-recoupable advance to deliver another record in less than a year and a half after the big one. And that record was basically a failure compared to the previous record. And then a new hierarchy was installed and they were bitching, why would I spend money on the Red Hot Chili Peppers? And, you know, why would I work with this one? They didn't like this. And then I just, you know, had another person come to me, a new chairman, said, you're making too much money. I said, but I'm delivering. He said, I need to cut our budget. And I just kind of locked myself in my office and was embarrassed because I was associated with Capital. I'd been approached by other record companies, and my response was always, I want to stay at Capital. I'm happy here. I didn't even have an attorney to that point in my career. So I said to myself, I don't want to ever be in a position again to be tossed away like trash. And I want to do something where I can use all my relationships and have a complete point of view on an artist's career. So I'm going to go into artist management and work with record companies and bring my knowledge to the party with them. And that's what I did. And I started a 30-year career of managing artists.
And so I want to get into the Columbus Music Commission, everything going on here too. Your career and how things have unfolded for you is so incredibly interesting. The artist management piece compared to everything that you were doing within Capital, how do those two elements fit together? Because it's like, you'll find the artist, but the manager is going to be in the middle. So the manager is kind of representing them. Is that how it's working?
Well, the manager looks at an artist's full career. And not every manager looks at artists like that. And so I knew the publishing business. I knew the touring business. I knew the record business. I knew all these aspects that come together or converge to become a whole for an artist's career. And I wanted to put that knowledge to use. So I had that time and that overview. And I wasn't working to the beating clock of the release schedule with 50 artists being released in a 12-month period. I could really focus on artist careers and start one then another. So you become an orchestrator. You work with the record company. You work with the publishers. You work with the accountants. You work with the lawyers. You work with the agents on booking. You work with all these different entities that come together. You literally become the chairman of the board of an artist's career. And the owner, or responsible to, is the artist. But you're the chairman of his board.
And because you know the ecosystem so well, there's no better person to trust to be the chairman, at least at that point in your career, than yourself.
I mean, it was winning over an artist because they sense, you know, they're like a hunting dog. They can sense which way the wind's blowing and the game is that way or the garbage is the other way. Most of them are sensible enough to know that. You know, they also sense when you're sincere and when you're passionate about them because their career is all they have. You might have 20 clients, so your career is maybe not to be dependent on any one of them, but an artist's career is all they have. So they respond to people that understand that.
And so at what point does Columbus come into the picture? And what point do you end up arriving here?
My wife, Beth, was born and raised in Columbus, though we met in New York and she'd been living there for 20 years. So from that first Christmas of bringing Bruce home to meet mom and dad, it started to crystallize why she had all these wonderful attributes: intelligent, stylish, down to earth, caring, great sense of humor. And it crystallized, like I said, when I got here, because I saw it in her parents. I saw it in her siblings. I saw it in the neighbors. I saw it everywhere. And I'd lived, like I said, in New York, London, and Los Angeles. And that first time that I visited Columbus, I started to have an extramarital affair, and her name was Columbus. And I saw this as a land of opportunity. But I would say, first of all, there's no smog. Skies are blue. There's no water shortage. The streets are clean. It's a progressive city. It doesn't suffer from industrial rustestation. Yes, it wasn't on a river. It wasn't on a Great Lake. It wasn't on the ocean. So there wasn't a crumbling economy. It was growing. And when you visit someplace, you tend to look at it through the lens of your career or your business. And I saw in the landscape lots of venues, a populace that loves music, lots of artists, lots of recording studios, but no music business infrastructure. And after about 7 years of visiting, I just got to the point where I felt like my career was becoming toxic. And I said goodbye to a few clients and my consultancy clients and just packed up our home, moved here, and sat for the first time in my life for 4 or 5 months doing nothing but enjoying living here.
So the toxic piece, I don't want to double down if it's too personal of a topic to talk about, but just to maybe a high level, if you're comfortable.
Well, Sinead O'Connor is clinically insane. I mean, that's not just a commentary from me. It's a well-known factor. And it's hard, no matter how much you care about a person, it's hard watching them destroy themselves or abuse you. It's just behavior you can't even understand. You know, someone is suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder, also acute bipolar disorder, and chronic borderline personality disorder. And it became abusive. It toxified my life at home, even. And that was probably what pushed me over the edge. And my mom and dad, my in-laws, were hitting 89 and 90, respectively. And one day I just turned to Beth and I said, do we want a phone call or do we want to be in Columbus? That was it. Like I said, packed up and moved here.
Has the digital shift and growth changed the way the ecosystem works? And has it shifted the way that, you know, if you look back on your career and it was in this day and age, would it be significantly different, do you think?
Oh my goodness, so vastly different. Because in those days, you signed artists by seeing them, listening to their demo tapes. And you depended on people in the industry to let you know about artists that might have been happening in their city or lawyers that represented. But there was no internet, so you didn't have a platform to see artists like today. And then, you know, it moved from just vinyl to cassettes, cassettes to CDs, CDs to file sharing. Ooh, bad, bad file sharers. From file sharing eventually to downloads, from like an Apple Music to streaming. And today, 80% of the business for record companies is streaming.
Yeah, it's just such an incredible change of events. And the amount of empires that were built and torn down as each one of those shifts happen is kind of incredible. So you come here and you see no infrastructure, quote unquote, from a music standpoint, but you see all this potential, but you've lived this long career already. You come back, you're tired. You want to just spend some time with family, it sounds like, and you say, I'm going to create something from the ground up here. That's got to be a bit daunting and challenging.
Well, I wanted to make a difference. When I saw Columbus, I said, you know, this is a city that I feel I can make a difference in. I want to find a way to weave myself into the fabric of the city. You know, whether it's volunteering for Nationwide Children's Hospital or any of the philanthropic organizations you can work with. And I was actually going to start a new company after I settled down with Scott Steinecker from Promo West. And a neighbor said, hey, Bruce, there's a Columbus Music Commission and they're looking for their first executive director. And I kind of pondered it and said, wow, that could tick all the boxes because I could give back some of the good the music business has given to me. I could help establish the fact, Columbus, that there's a huge music business economy. And I could see a tangible difference being made. You know, gold records, that's great. I, you know, earn those or been to the Grammys or been to the Academy Awards and all that. But I don't want to sound like snobby about it, but it wasn't something I could grab onto. And today, when I see a kid with an instrument in his hands because we did a gift of music instrument campaign, or I see industry people coming to Columbus to talk to the musicians, which is a program we created called Music Business Mondays, and they all utter the same four words. I had no idea about Columbus. So it's been a road, and it's really something that's really fulfilled my desire. It's a blank canvas that someone gave me, just like when I got to Capitol Records. Here, do something with it. And I didn't know how to run a nonprofit, but I learned quickly, and I have a great board. And that's the, you know, just the beginning of the story.
And what do you think the future looks like?
The future's bright because now business leaders and government leaders, important people, developers, people without and through the government, understand that music speaks. Music is a major economy. Music contributes $170 billion a year to the gross domestic product of this country. Not just records, all music. And I say, where's our slice of that pie? 21 Pilots. From here, no one in their food chain is in Columbus. Camp, another band I love. No one in their food chain, meaning the manager's not here, the label's not here, the publisher's not here, the lighting designers aren't here, the bus drivers aren't here, the publishers aren't here, the promotion people aren't here. They had to leave because there was no infrastructure. So now we're working towards creating an infrastructure. You know, my goal is for Columbus to be looked upon as the Midwest music capital of America. And I think we can do that.
How long do you think that'll take?
But we're on the road. Probably to get that kind of notoriety, 3 years. But there's no telling. It's like releasing an artist's album. You know, will it take 4 years for their career to happen? Or could you catch lightning in a bottle? But we're launching this year Better Together Music Incubator. So artists now are being given, the applicants that are chosen, are being given career counseling, a professional photo session, vocal coaching from a professional coach, songwriting workshops, recording time, video production, digital marketing classes, financial management over a 5-month period. It sounds academic, but it's not that academic, and it'll take place on Saturdays usually. But those are artists that'll get to the next stage in their career. And in 24, I hope to launch a music accelerator, which for all intents and purposes, I hope will become the first nonprofit record label, at least in the state of Ohio, if not the first successful nonprofit record label in the country.
So I think that's a great final place to wrap up. I think that what you're doing here and your vision and what you've achieved so far is awesome. And Columbus is lucky to have an individual like yourself and the energy and what you're looking to do and leaving the city. Are there any final words for listeners throughout Columbus that you might have?
Support live music and visit www.musiccolumbus.com.
And our final question of the show, centered around the theme, which is live uncomfortably. And when you look back on your life and career, does it mean anything to you? Does it apply to your life and career? What do you think of when you hear the phrase?
I mean, I remember starting my career sharing an apartment with three other guys, eating ketchup sandwiches on Wonder Bread, going from that to tuna, never wishing that we had or missing the fact we didn't have steak. And I look at my life and am blessed for this, that every tomorrow is better than yesterday.
Well, Bruce, thank you so much for joining us. This is a great episode, and I appreciate you sitting down.
Thanks for having me.